When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Hello, my name is Katie Walker, and here at the Send Parenting Balance podcast, we talk all things parenting children with autism, ADHD, and or PDA. Now, today's podcast is going to be a little bit different to the other ones, and this is going to be diving into lots of questions that you guys have been asking me either on social media or via my email or via my DMs. So we're going to dive straight into quite a few questions from you guys, questions about home education, questions about mainstream education, any HCPs, questions about my own children, about reasonable adjustments, and also questions about how do you know when it's the right time to perhaps pull your child out of school. The first question was, what was the first thing that I did when I deregistered Emily from school? How did I get her interested in learning again? Love this question. So for those that don't know, my daughter has autism and ADHD. She is now 14, but I deregistered her in year 7 when she was in school. Now, firstly, I deregistered her on the last day of term in July. So that was the last day of her, what would have been year 7. And to me at that time, timing was everything. This meant that she could kind of unschool over the summer holidays when all of her friends were also off and the sun was out. So she had 6 weeks to recover from school, get used to a new environment, and oh my goodness, recovery was exactly what she did. In September, we then started home education classes, and I only started with her favourite interests. So this is how I got her interested in learning again. We only went in with her favourite thing. So we did no maths, we did no English, we did no science. In fact, to begin with, we did no academics at all. I didn't want her nervous about these subjects. So Emily enjoys art, drama, singing, dance, photography, and also kind of project work. So we started there. Now, obviously, amongst these subjects, she's also doing English, science, and maths. For example, one of her topics for her projects was to start her own business making friendship bracelets. So we did lots of maths about how we'd price that up and what our inventory would be. How we'd pay taxes, how much she would need to earn per hour. We were looking at minimum wages. Obviously, we were doing the design of these bracelets and designing a web page. And there was quite a lot involved with it. So she was obviously practicing her English skills, her persuasive writing, her sales pitches. And so just because we weren't focusing necessarily on maths, English and science classes didn't mean that we weren't actually practicing them as we went. I attended every class with her initially because that's what she requested, and we only did classes outside of the house. So I didn't want home ed ruining our relationship in the way that I was then having to always nag her. I wanted somebody else to teach her. Now, the classes weren't really expensive. They were about £6 per class, which I didn't find too bad. And bearing in mind that she doesn't do after school clubs or swimming clubs or have a great social life at that time, I didn't feel like it was too expensive in comparison to what other children were doing just outside of school. So I attended every class with her, which is what she requested, and within 4 months she had made lots of friends and didn't want me there, which was fantastic for her independence. After she'd made friends, her confidence in herself grew, and then after another 9 months of using this approach of just going in with her favorite interests. She was able to layer in academic classes. Initially, I only booked her in classes that she could easily achieve. Now, every child is different. So I went slightly below her age, the year below, which in turn boosted her self-confidence and her can-do attitude before moving on to her harder lessons. Because this meant that she could do the work and she felt really pleased with herself that she was excelling in each and every lesson. We're now in year two of home education, and only last week, Emily asked if we could do more classes. More core academic classes, that is. And this is fantastic. And absolutely, yes, we can. It is possible to recover from mainstream school and find happiness again. And for reference, Emily has ADHD, autism, PDA, severe anxiety, and a sleep disorder. And before we went into home education, she had had nearly 8 months off of school. She was self-harming and she had a hair pulling disorder. And so she really did need that time to recover from mainstream and then go back into a completely new environment that was very small initially, and then slowly we layered it back in. So I really hope that that gives you the answer to your question and how I got her loving learning again and where we started. The next question is, what are the rules about reduced timetables and missing lessons such as PE, music, and drama? Great question. There's a lot of confusion around these rules. And that's because the rules will be different based on which school your child attends and which local authority you're under. Some are definitely kinder than others, and this inconsistency is really unfair and very confusing. So, all schools, in fact, can offer a reduced timetable. And in fact, in times of need, most will for a period of a few weeks. But the school's aim will always be to get the child back to full-time education because the school's priorities will always be attendance, whereas our parental responsibilities or priorities, sorry, will be perhaps our child's mental health over and above school attendance, and quite right too. But you'll see the priorities don't match. You'll likely need to really battle to keep a reduced timetable for longer than 6 to 8 weeks with a school. However, it's not impossible. Some schools are very kind with this and accommodating. It is known that one option can actually be part-time school and part-time home education. However, I'm yet to find parents who have achieved this long term. There are rules in place, but unfortunately, due to the funding issues, amongst many other societal difficulties, the rules just aren't being adhered to in favour of special needs children. Hence, why there's so many families battling services at the moment. It's always worth approaching the school and asking them if you can have a reduced timetable due to the mental health of your child or due to their difficulties. And every school can, if they choose to, say yes, but it will be for a period of time, probably with the outcome of going back into full time within 6 to 8 weeks, I would imagine. In regards to your second question, some schools bend over backwards to try and help and will really easily remove non-important classes from a child's timetable, at least in the short term, such as music, PE, drama, especially if a child has a diagnosis and or an EHCP. My child didn't need to do PE as she hated getting changed for PE and couldn't handle team games. So instead she worked in the centre provision area, which she preferred. However, I have heard that other schools are not as kind. The rules, therefore, are non-consistent between schools. It is down to head teacher discretion and obviously local authorities. If you are requesting either part-time school and/or reduction of lessons due to anxiety or additional needs, then you can request for reasonable adaptations to be put in place. And of course, if your child has an EHCP, then you would hope that these would be adhered to. But if you are told no to either of your requests, then I would ask in writing for why these reasonable adjustments have been denied. This will then hold the school accountable for their decision because they'll have to back it up with a why, but it would also provide you evidence in attempting to meet need, but it being met with resistance by the school. Truth is that schools have a lot of power to put lots of reasonable adjustments in place, and I'm sure most of them want to, but due to the funding and the staff issues, this can mean that it can be really hard, almost impossible in some cases, to facilitate. For example, when Emily didn't want to take part in PE and then sat with a member of staff in the SEND provision area doing other work, this meant that the school had to provide that member of staff for her to sit with, and in order to make that reasonable adjustment possible. And some schools' funding just doesn't spread to that, unfortunately. It's not okay by any means, because it means we're in a bit of a school postcode lottery, and it's certainly not fair. But it does seem that some schools can be supportive and it is worth asking for. Have you considered changing schools to a school that is more supportive? Would be my question if you are met with resistance or unhappy where you are. There's no reason why you can't meet other schools and speak to the SENCOs before you apply for school places to see if they can meet need. Another question was how my son's EHCP was getting on. I did this via TikTok with those of you that follow me on TikTok, actually, and I shared each step of the application with you. Some of you did it with me, and I've already heard that you have already got your EHCPs, which is amazing, and congratulations. However, I'm still waiting for my tribunal in May 2025. Can you believe it? I'm hoping it's overturned over the next few weeks, perhaps in April, but I am not entirely sure. I don't have the school support, a very similar story to many of you, I'm sure, and so I must now wait. Within our last year of waiting, Harry's needs have increased, and so it's a very frustrating process. The process was full of lots of parental blame, lots of cherry picking of evidence from the school side, which meant I had to send in letters of complaint and parental statements in responses to statements that had been put in place that weren't true. All is late evidence. It's been really stressful, but we're nearly there, and I am hoping that if it's not at least overturned in April, that he will get his EHCP assessment in May. So let's all keep our fingers crossed for me. And thank you for checking in on me, those that have sent messages to find out how that's been going on. Somebody emailed me in the week to ask what happens if you do not take up the offer of mediation when you complete an EHCP. And the answer is nothing. I have never taken up the offer to do mediation. I sometimes think, in my own opinion, of course, that this can just cause delay and add time on. Some families have accepted the mediation and got the reasonable adjustments that they were wanting through an agreement with the school, which is absolutely fantastic. However, I'm under the opinion that my personal circumstances mean that I'm looking for an EHCP because I want it to last right up until the child has left school, so that it doesn't matter what school they're in or what college or how their needs change over time, or if I moved school or moved house and therefore moved area, that EHCP and all of the reasonable adaptations that were needed would have to be held accountable for. I always worry when making plans just with one school, because then when you go to the next school, you may then have that battle again and again. And of course, every school works differently. So if it's taken 2 years to battle for reasonable adjustments in, say, the infant school, you may then have to do it again in the junior school and again in the secondary school. And so for me, an EHCP feels like a solution to those battles, which is why I never say yes to mediation. I haven't said it to either of mine. I'm still waiting for Harry's EHCP, as I've just said, but with Emily's, it still went through, which was fantastic. I didn't even need the mediation. Now, as you know, with my daughter's EHCP, she had speech and language assessments, occupational therapy assessments, and educational psychology assessments as part of her EHCP. And it was found that she had autism, ADHD, severe social and communication disorder, dyslexia, and severe anxiety. And I was absolutely mortified that finally, at the age 12, she was seen and heard when I'd been fighting since she was 6 years old. The next question. Now, I really love this question. This came through on one of my videos, and it said, how do you have such a great relationship with your daughter with her additional needs? And you know what? The truthful answer is that it hasn't always been this way. It took work. I really had to start to see the world through her eyes in order to try and help accommodate the best way I could. We've had school avoidance, we've had violence, lots of violence and aggression, we've had dangerous behaviours. And yes, at times I've wondered if I'm even the right person for the job, because at times everything I've tried just didn't seem to be working. I'm sure that sounds familiar to some listeners. I then changed my environment massively with lots of little tweaks, tweaks that no one really noticed but me. And man, they had such a huge impact. I share this with you actually in my Breaking Barriers, Building Belief pre-recorded support course. Feel free to go along to the website www.sendparentingbalance.com, click on the programs tab, and have a look at the topics that are involved. It details exactly what I did to fill my children's cups and carve a new path forwards positively. And it's aimed at families who have children under the age of 12, as Emily was back then, that maybe have autism, ADHD, and/or PDA. And we cover so many topics. I couldn't list them all here, but if you go over and check it out, you will see 15 to 20 topics that we cover easily. So go and check it out on the programs page to see all those little tweaks that I managed to do. Next question. I get this one such a lot. I'm going to say maybe three or four times a week. Will you ever homeschool Harry? I have a plan of sorts, actually. He actually enjoys school most of the time, but I'm not sure he will continue to based on his needs. I think so far I've got really lucky with a kind and empathetic year three teacher, and I wonder if this will be the same with teacher change in year four. Emily has 2 more years of home education, and so I'm hoping that I can keep Harry afloat within mainstream at least until year five, and this will be when Emily finishes home education. This means I can then divert my full attention from Emily's home education journey onto Harry's home education journey if he needs it. However, I'm not fully certain he's going to make it that far. So if he needs to come out early, then so be it. I will think of a new plan. As we always do, us mums always have plan A, B, and C. And we do tend to always fall on plan B or C in my case. And I, in the meantime, I will try and do all I can to ensure he's happy for as long as possible. A good question to put on the end of this one actually is, how do you know it's the right time to pull your child out of school? When is enough enough? This question makes me a little sad because, in my personal experience, I certainly left Emily too long. So, based on my opinion, I would say as soon as your intuition tells you that you'd rather keep them home, that's when you pull them out. Now, of course, that would be different for everybody. You know your child best, and so you know when they would have had enough. I stupidly kept pushing Emily. I kept going to the meetings. I kept fighting for reasonable adjustments that weren't put in place. I sat through hours of meetings of parental stigma and blame. I had panic attacks myself after leaving meetings and sitting in the car. Nobody heard me. Nobody seemed to understand the discriminative comments. They were awful. And by the time the school eventually applied for funding for an intervention, I think it was Forest School once a week for 6 weeks. It was 9 months after I requested it, and it was too late, and she wouldn't have gone anyway. The parental stress was absolutely massive. I look back now and I swear it's caused some sort of PTSD, and Emily in particular was treated awfully and definitely has school trauma, base trauma. And it wasn't through direct abuse, of course, but just through direct misunderstanding, and it's so harmful. I remember going into the school after an evening that she had self-harmed, and I was so worried. I think that's one behaviour as a parent that can feel really out of control. You spend all these years protecting your children, fighting for your children, keeping them safe, and then they self-harm. It's really tough. That's a whole podcast of itself, is it not? So I went along to this meeting, and the school staff members were cross that I hadn't sent Emily into school. And I was mortified that this child had been self-harming just hours prior, and yet they were more annoyed. Nobody asked me how she was. Nobody referred us to CAMHS mental health or tried. They just literally was worried that she hadn't been into school, that it was affecting her attendance, and implied that it was attention seeking and behavioural. And the implications came through their discriminative and dismissive comments. And I remember feeling like this is not the place. We do not belong. I don't belong in this meeting. That this is almost pointless because they cannot see the truth and they cannot see what's really going on. Therefore, everything we're talking about in relation to attendance is not applicable. And it was after this meeting that we left. It was in this time for me that timing was everything. But honestly, in hindsight, I wish I hadn't have let it get that far. I never knew it would have got that far. And looking back, so it was year seven I took her out. I think I likely should have taken her out 4 years earlier. It was 4 years earlier, in about year three or year four, that she was showing signs of struggle and masking. But I kept listening to the school and thinking that, you know, they're professionals, they know best. Whereas actually, they're professionals of education. They're not professionals in mental health. I have learned over time that actually they don't know best at all. I kept hearing things like, she's a little bit behind, but she'll catch up. Or I kept hearing, it's a home problem. She's fine in school. Have you done an MVR course? Do you need a parenting course? And I kept thinking that somehow, you know, it was me. Perhaps I was too sensitive. Perhaps I should have been pushing her harder. Perhaps she will catch up if she works harder. But the outcome was none of these. In fact, the outcome was much, much worse. And to be honest, not worth the gamble, in my opinion. I know of many families that hold on in there fighting for their child's needs to be met. And indeed, some do manage it. But I would suggest that if the school do not show regular understanding or change within at least 3 to 6 months of you going in and having meetings, then I would be looking at other options, in my own personal opinion. Many people have asked me over the last year, what should you look for in a school? So if your child has no SEN school placement, or they're not SEND enough for a SEN placement — my children aren't SEND enough for a SEN placement, but they're too SEND enough for mainstream — then what should we be looking for in a mainstream school? Well, I've worked in four schools, and obviously my children have been through three different schools. And to be honest, it's all about environment. So ideally, you want to be looking for big open spaces, because big open spaces means your child, particularly if they have sensory processing disorder, it will make them feel better rather than feeling all crammed in. So go and have a little look around. You'll likely get a feel for the place as you do so. And sometimes you don't even need to know why you've got that feeling. You'll just get this gut feeling. Follow it. If the building is an older style building, then you'll likely find the classrooms are really big and airy. The older style buildings are always the ones to go for. In comparison to the new builds of schools, they are tiny and the classrooms are very boxed in. My son's year three junior school classroom is ridiculously tiny. His chair at his table backs onto another child's chair sitting behind him. It's pretty small. And this means that children with sensory processing disorder may struggle more with less space. Crowded means that children can push past regularly. It means that it can feel more crammed, more noisy. It's not ideal. Ideally, you're looking for the smallest amount of pupils in a school. So if you're looking in your local postcode area, have a look at how many pupils are registered in each of the school, and ideally go with the smallest number of pupils. The smallest number of pupils means the staff will have more time for your child. The larger amount of children, the more issues that the school can face with behaviour and funding, etc. You want to look for lots of open spaces within the school as well, such as sensory rooms and quiet areas. Lots of outdoor space means that the school will likely use it for forest schools and outdoor learning. Then you need to look at the teachers. So is your child's teacher a full-time teacher, or do they have split duties? If they're, say, a full-time teacher and SENCO, or a full-time teacher and head of year, then the likelihood is they're going to be out of the classroom a lot, which means children will have a lot of staff changes. And this can be hard to deal with for some children, mine included. Is there a SENCO, an ELSA, a therapeutic group leader, or does the SENCO do all of the above? If the SENCO is all of the above, so if they deal with the emotional literacy support and the therapeutic groups, and they deal with it as all the special needs children, and obviously everything that the role of a SENCO comes with the safeguarding too, then I would question whether or not they would have a lot of time for you. Whereas if the school has different members of staff, a therapeutic group leader, a separate SENCO, a separate safeguarding lead, a separate ELSA, then you may get a better service from them. They'll have more time per special needs family. Ideally, two SENCOs is a privilege. You can always meet with the SENCO prior to your child going to a school, explain your child's needs, and see if the school believe they can meet their need before your child goes there. One word of note, please don't focus too heavily on the Ofsted reports. As you know, I've worked in schools, and Ofsted reports are quite frankly really crap. They don't give a true picture of the school, particularly the SEND departments. They really do have no idea. I have only ever worked in a school with terrible Ofsted reports because they all have the best SEND support. I'll say it again, I've only ever worked in schools with terrible Ofsted reports because they have the best SEND support, and that says it all. The statement says it all in a nutshell. Ofsted measure the wrong things, in my opinion. My personal dream is to move to a tiny coastal village, and interestingly, I often wonder if Harry would even need all of the reasonable adjustments that he would now if I did move there, because I bet the schools in a tiny coastal village would have a small number of pupils and large open spaces, and I bet that his needs could easily be met in a smaller environment. However, I can't afford to move there, but it goes to show that environment is everything. That's not to say that his autism, ADHD, and PDA will magically disappear, because obviously it can't, but it is to say that the environment would be kinder to the side effects of these diagnoses and therefore give him a better chance to thrive. So it's, if you're looking at schools, thinking about the environment. The last question, how do you accept it all? This is a really good question, and I'm not sure I do fully all the time. Anyone will know in the SEND world, there's lots of peaks and troughs, there's lots of ups and downs. Some days are great, some days are not so great. It took many tears and many years, that's for sure. And sometimes I do still find it hard to accept when I see a work opportunity that I could do. You could take my social media page, for example, and I see Facebook friends and acquaintances that perhaps haven't seen in real life for 10 years booking a holiday, and then it's hard to accept it all, or easily moving house, and that's hard to accept it all, or even having some sort of a social life and regular hobbies and running marathons. I'm trying to think of the things that I've seen recently on social media, and yes, then I look at it and I think I wish I could, because me as a person absolutely could do all of those things, but it's my life that holds me back slightly. So lots of tears and many years, and it's still really hard to accept at times. Do you know what though? I've got to be honest, I feel really privileged that I am part of the home education world, and it was the home education world that taught me acceptance. I'll tell you why. This is really interesting. The home education world is full of parents that have had the same journeys as I have, and perhaps you too. They are the most accepting bunch of people I have ever met, ever, ever, ever in my whole life. I only wish and yearn for the fact that I grew up in that same environment. And the fact that Emily, my daughter, has had a chance to experience these people and their views on the world and their level of acceptance, I am so grateful. And I never thought I would ever say that. It's a level of acceptance that just isn't present in the mainstream world. They don't worry about what's happening in the mainstream world at all because they're too busy carving the way forward, their own way forward for their children, a better way. Their confidence and ability outshines, and I am in complete awe of anyone who fully home educates all of their children and have done it from birth. And is fully embedded in that home education life. Obviously, I've only got one in home ed and one in mainstream, so I've kind of got one foot in each. I'm split into two worlds. I much prefer the home education world, and the impact that that has on children's mental health is massive. It's completely different. And it's really hard to put into words why it's so different, but it's just full of acceptance. There's no bitchiness or drama between the girls. And they have to remember Emily's 14, so she's at a very dramatic age. There's no worry about who's wearing Nike trainers or what hoodie you're wearing. There's no comparison with other children about hair or makeup or tan or nails. All of the stuff that was in mainstream, all of that has gone. There's no ability comparison because all of the lessons are mixed ages. And so suddenly children aren't comparing themselves to other people. They're not worried about whether they're top of the class, bottom of the class, middle of the class, whether they need help. All the children are just taught the best way that suits them. It's really mixed, and that has a very good impact on their mental health. And these are just a few changes that means that children's self-worth and self-confidence really starts to grow. Everyone has quirky behaviors, and yet everybody supports and loves everybody's quirks. Nobody's taking the mickey out of anybody else. There is a child in Emily's class that dresses up as an animal in each lesson, and I can only imagine what mainstream would do to him. But all of the children absolutely love this little boy and speak of him so fondly that it warms my heart. It is the most accepting community that I have ever been a part of. And that is how I learned acceptance. That's the answer to the question because I actually prefer it. And by watching people really thrive in a world that they maybe didn't choose, but they've ended up in it, is very, very attractive. Although I've got to say, I don't want it to sound like everything's now fine. I still have Harry in mainstream. I still struggle with cabin fever when he doesn't want to leave the house at weekends. I still struggle with adult company and loneliness. I still struggle with anxiety because of the cabin fever, and I hardly get out or see anybody. And I definitely miss the flexibility that I would have had if both children were in school. So, for example, I could take more working opportunities, but nothing's perfect, right? And based on the fact that the children have the diagnosis that they have, which I couldn't have prepared for, and I certainly feel like I got thrown into it without much warning, then I think I've got it as perfect as I can. It took 4 years to get here, but worth the fight and the wait, to be honest. I loved answering all your questions. I really hope that that's helped. If you have any further questions, I will do another podcast in this style next month. So do DM me on TikTok or email me. And don't forget to check out my website, www.sendparentingbalance.com, and sign up for free for updates and discounts every single month. And also, not forgetting those very important neuro spicy rants. Take care.